I would like to prejudice our study this morning with a comment or two before we get into it. If you were going to give the standard Christian answer to this question, what would your answer be? And I don't expect you to shout it out. Is it true or not true that God hears and answers the prayer of unbelievers more than believers? Most of us would say that's not true. But when we read verses 26 through 39, we find two sets of unbelievers making requests that Jesus grants, and one guy who's a believer making a request and Jesus turns him down. Seems like it'd be better to be the unbelievers in that case. That way you get what you want. But don't be too sure about that. When we first came to Lincolnton, we did a study called Developing Perspective, because as we have said many, many times, everything depends upon definitions, and perspective is what drives the definitions. We make our words mean what they mean because of the perspective we have already adopted. And in the record before us this morning, there are two vastly different perspectives regarding Jesus. One makes sense, and the other is completely nuts. But just as he acquiesced to the request of the demons when they entreated him not to torment them or to send them into the abyss, but to give them the permission to enter into the pigs, he acquiesced to their request, and that's part of the record here. But in the text that we're going to be looking at this morning, it says in verse 34, and I'm going to try to get all the way through verse 39 this morning. It says, when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. Now, what had happened is 2,000 pigs had just drowned that they'd been watching. And the people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they became frightened. And those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well. And all of the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to depart from them, for they were gripped with great fear, and he got into a boat and returned. But the man from whom the demons had gone out was begging him that he might accompany him, but he sent him away, saying, "Return to your house and describe what great things God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. Just like with the demons. Don't send us into the abyss. Give us the pigs. Jesus acquiesced. In this case, all of the people of the land of the Gerasenes said, "Would you please leave?" And so he left. But the guy that he had done this great thing for was begging him, "Let me go with you." And he said, "Nope." I think it's highly significant in this text that the prayers of the opponents are given the requested response, and the prayer of the only one in his right mind was denied. Why is this? Why does God give permission to the wicked to accomplish their desires and restrain those whom he has saved from their desires? Almost without exception, people think that ought to be the other way around. I mean, if you're willing to trust him and he saves you, you ought to be able to pray and he ought to give you what you ask for. And if you're wicked and hateful and you ask him for something, he ought to tell you no and make you suffer. That's the way 99.44% of people think. But this passage doesn't agree with that. I think the answer to the conundrum that we face in this reality is found in the single word in this text that is actually Luke's record of addressing what Jesus had intended to do even before he told his disciples over there in verse 22 and following. He told his disciples to go over to the other side of the lake, get in a boat and let's go over there. He knew what he was going to do when he got there. He knew what his plan was. He knew what situation he was looking into. And the fact is, when he got it done, he got in his boat and left. So he didn't send them over there through all that storm and all the terror and all that stuff just to land and then leave and go back. He went over there to deal with this fellow that was possessed by a legion of demons, and then he left. There's one word at the end of verse 36 that tells us why he went, and I think is the explanation for the whole puzzle. The New American Standard translators decided to translate it, "had been made well." Verse 36 says, "Those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well." There's our word. Got a lot of English words to translate the tenses and all that stuff. Had been made well. Passive tense, aorist, and so on. The problem is, and you're getting used to this, right? The word doesn't mean to make well. I looked up this word on the online dictionary thing that lists the number of times it's used in the Bible and all that, and I discovered some things that I'm going to share with you. But before I share those, I just want to make you aware that there are a couple of ways that words are given definition. I told you at the very beginning of this introduction that everything depends on definition, but definition depends on perspective. And there are a lot of things that enter into how people define words. I mean, we run into this all the time. The guy says, "I love you," but what he really means is, "I want to have sex with you." Using a word doesn't mean what he wants the woman to think it means, or given it's June, maybe it's not a woman. Sorry. Couldn't withstand the sarcasm. It just makes me sick. But anyway, there are ways that words are given definition, and one of those ways is to look at how the word is used in the various contexts in which you find it, and then develop a definition out of those uses so that you will actually allow the people who are using the word to tell you what they mean by looking at what they say in multiple places. That's the way you do legitimate Bible study. You don't go to the Bible and say, "I already know what it says, so I just want to look at this word to prove that I'm right." And that's silly. You go to the Bible and you say, "Okay, it has this word. What does this word mean?" And then you look it up in a bunch of places and you say, "Oh, okay, then every time it's used in these places, it can kind of has this connotation, so I'm going to define it this way." Now I realize that the people that write the dictionaries and lexicons are supposed to have done that all for us so that we can be lazy and just pull the definition out of the book, but that's not how we're supposed to do it. The other way is to look at the results that accrue from the word's impact in its context and then give a definition that seems to fit the results. And that's what the New American Standard translators did here. They looked at the results of the word and they said, "Okay, now this guy's demon-free and he's in his right mind. The results of Jesus' activity here, described by this word, are that he is in better shape than he was, so we'll just say he was made well." But when we do our homework and we look into the uses of the word that's in question here at the end of verse 36, "he had been made well," we find that it's used 110 times in the New Testament, and the translators of the Authorized Version, which is the only version that the online Bible actually gives you all this data for, so that's why I'm appealing to it. But those translators, out of 110 opportunities to translate this word, chose to render it "to save" 93 times, and only 3 times did they decide to say that it meant something to do with healing. And none of those 3 times that they chose to translate it "to heal" are service better than the 93-time translation thing "to save." I mean, we come across with the same conclusions with a little modification to that statement, but nonetheless, if they'd have gone ahead and translated the word "to save" those 3 times they chose to translate it "to heal," we'd still come across with the understanding that they'd been delivered, like that's what the text says. And if it was a physical thing, we'd understand that that deliverance included physical health and its return. So we would say, "Well, he's healed. He's made well. Fine." But if you have to do that for whatever reason, 3 times out of 110, I have a little question for you. Why? The fact is that the word sozo in the Greek New Testament means to save. And it always has in view a present or impending disaster that the person is being delivered from. So that if there is a present disaster, like being possessed with 7,000 demons, and you have been delivered from them, you have been saved. If it's an impending disaster, such as a few hours before on the lake, there's this hurricane of wind and the boat's getting swamped and the sailors all know they're going to die. I mean, they've been fishermen and they know they're going to die. It's impending. And they say, Lord, save us. We're going to die. They didn't really say save us. It just says they came to him and said, Master, we're going to die. Well, what they wanted to be was saved from the storm, from the death that it was going to mete out to them. So we don't run into any difficulty if we understand that sozo just means that you're going to be delivered from this present or this impending disaster. Disaster is always in view and deliverance is always the outcome. And if you want to translate a healing, fine, except that it's not as good a translation as saved. Because healing gives you the impression that they were suffering some kind of a physical infirmity. And the fact is that neither this text nor does any study of Scripture indicate that demon possession is a sickness that needs to be healed. It is not. In America, we diagnose people with multiple personality disorder and all kinds of stuff where their actual physical behavior changes, their voice changes, their demeanor changes, their attitude changes, their character changes. It's all in the same body, but there's all these. And we say, well, this is just another manifestation of another personality within this body. This poor guy's got a mental disease. He needs to be healed. Well, he's not sick. He doesn't need to be healed. He needs to be saved. He needs to be delivered from those things that are dominating and ruining him. So the fact is, the text doesn't indicate that the man was sick. Demon possession is not a sickness. Sickness comes from an immune system breakdown somewhere along the line. And demons don't create immune system breakdowns along the line. They just take over the brain. That was the problem with the pigs. They took over a bunch of little brains they didn't know how to manipulate. The poor pigs were so shocked by losing their minds, literally, their brains, that they took off running down the steep slope, and then they couldn't stop, so they drowned. It wasn't an immune system problem. It was a brain problem. The man was not sick. He was tormented day and night by some wicked, wicked spirits. His experience was an unmitigated disaster, if you read verse 29. He didn't need somebody to come along and heal him. He needed somebody to come along who was more powerful than the spirits that controlled him and could banish them from his body. That's what he needed. He needed a powerful person who could say to the demons, get out of here. And they would have to obey. He'd lived with them long enough to know that it'd take somebody with a lot of potency to be able to do that, because I'm sure that in those times when the demons said, okay, you can have your brain back for a little while, that he wished with all that was in him that he'd never done whatever it was that he had done to let them come into his body in the first place. And he probably cried and screamed, get out of me, leave me alone, and on and on and on. And they'd just ignore him because they didn't have to obey him. So what he needed was somebody to come along that they couldn't ignore. That's what he needed. He wasn't sick. He was tormented. And when Jesus came along, he didn't heal him. He saved him from the clutches of those demons. He said to the demons, get out of here! And then the man was able to be restored to his rightful use of his brain, his right mind. So I think the man got saved. Now, do I mean that in the technical theological sense of justification by faith? Well, yeah, I do mean that, but that's not I mean, that's a conclusion I draw from verse 39, not from what Jesus did with the demons. Jesus warned the religious establishment on one occasion that if they were able to get a demon to leave a body, but if that person who got the demon out or was released from it, if he didn't do something more than just a little house cleaning, that maybe seven more demons would come back, and then it's worse. His state would be worse. And if seven was worse, think about 7,000. So I'm not saying that exercising the demons led or was the manifestation of justification by faith, but I do believe that verses 38 and 39 tell us that there's something happened in the man's heart as well as in his body. But the fact is, verse 36 says, those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been saved or delivered. Now, I want to ask you this question. Who were those who had seen it? The text in Matthew tells us that there were two demoniacs, this 6,800 and whatever demons that were there, had so dominated these two men's bodies that they terrorized the whole area, and nobody would go down the road that led past the graveyard that these two guys inhabited. And I'll just absolutely guarantee you that that included pig farmer herdsmen. They weren't going to put their pigs over there close to that graveyard. There's no way. So they were herding their pigs over on the mountainside with a steep slope into the sea. And when Jesus landed, they may have been able to see afar off. Uh-oh, that poor sucker doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to go down that road. Oh, here come those guys. They're going to get him. They might have been able to see. That's all speculation. But you know, speculation's good for the soul, right? That's why Paul told Timothy, don't engage in it. But the point is, I don't think they were close enough to hear what was being said. So who were those that reported it? The only other people there were the disciples. Maybe this was their introduction to the preaching tour they were going to go on in the next chapter. Who knows? But they had seen it, and they reported to all of the people that were coming out of the land of the Gerasenes to see what had happened, and they saw this man in his right mind and clothed for the first time in months in the sense of having a hamartion on. And they were scared. And the ones who saw it increased their fear by telling them how it happened. And then they asked Jesus to leave. Because, it says in verse 37, they were gripped with great fear. So when we are told at the end of verse 36 that the man had been saved, in the physical sense of demons being exorcised, kicked out, and then probably also because of verse 38 and 39, an inner transforming thing that happened in his heart and mind toward Jesus, that we would also say, well, this was the point of his conversion, his salvation. We can use saved that way only because verses 38 and 39 imply it. But that leads me to the next thing I want to say. Every time a word is used, it has implied meanings that run everywhere. And those implied meanings are not what the word actually means, but the word drags them along. If I tell you that after church this morning, we're going to go out North Aspen, and if it's after 12 o'clock, we're going to stop at Aldi and buy a cantaloupe, because my mother-in-law likes cantaloupes. And we're supposed to be at her house tomorrow night. If I tell you we're going to buy a cantaloupe, there are all kinds of things that are attached to all those words. Buy and cantaloupe and mother-in-law and the whole nine yards. I mean, every word has a... It's full. If I say buy, you automatically understand that I'm going to have to open my wallet. You understand that. Buy doesn't mean open your wallet. But the implication's there. Buy also means that the folks at Aldi will accept whatever I pull out of my wallet if I'm going to buy from them. So being willing to accept it is implied. The fact that there's something there to buy implies a whole lot of stuff about farming and cantaloupe growing and the whole You know, my mother told me yesterday morning that watermelons in Tyler are selling for $8 a piece. And I said, we're in the wrong business. Who would think you had to pay $8 for a watermelon? Anyway, my point here is that as soon as a word is used, there is a whole host of things that get dragged into the thought of the individual that hears it, and there is a perspective that is established by those implied meanings that govern whether or not there'll be any understanding to follow. When Luke says that the man was saved from the demons and then by implication also from his sin, he drags a whole bunch of stuff into this text by using the word who had been saved. This fact that these words carry this is the reason why Jesus was able to say that men live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Because every word that God ever says is connected to everything in His universe. And therefore, if He utters a word, somehow that word's connected to everything that's involved in His life. And if you believe that word, it drags some of that life into your life. Because faith in the word has all the stuff that it drags along with it. Well, when Luke used the word in verse 36, that those who had seen it reported to them how the man had been saved, he dragged a whole bunch of stuff into this text. He intended, I believe, to draw a line in the sand between the demons, the Gerasenes, and this saved man. That's three, but there's a line there. And I believe that that gives us the reason for the conundrum that I presented to you at the beginning. The reason Jesus gave permission to the wicked and refused permission to the saved man. Why did Jesus give permission to the demons to go into the pigs instead of into the abyss? Well, I believe that it's because that's the way salvation works. What do you mean? Well, let me qualify that by saying it this way. In respect to demons, there is no salvation. So, there's really no need to not give them what they ask. Say, what? Well, I would think that'd be every reason not to give them what they want. No. If they can't be saved because they've already crossed the line, then there isn't any reason to turn down their request now. Because letting the wicked have their way is a form of judgment. Stupid always brings its own consequences. And kids, don't forget what I said last week. Stupid's not a nice word to use, but the Bible does use it on occasion. So I'm going to just bring it in here. But be careful about your use of that term. The fact is, it brings its own consequences. So if you're that way and you ask for something and God gives it to you, guess what's going to happen to you? Something bad. Because it's a form of judgment to give the wicked what they ask for. On the one hand, it allows them to persist in the delusion that they have of their autonomy. This is a huge delusion. The demons actually believed that if Jesus had just leave them alone, they could do as they pleased. And that delusion of autonomy is, I mean, we addressed that somewhat last week. The fact that you can't, you're not autonomous, you're a creature. That means your desire to live a Jesus-free life is delusional. You can't. You can't get away from Him. The demons can't either, even though they're not given a possibility of salvation because they don't want it. They're past that. But the fact is, they still think that they can do pretty much as they please as long as God doesn't get in their way. And when God gets in their way and they ask Him and He gives them the request they ask, what does that do to their impression of their autonomy? They say, oh, He's not even going to get in our way. We can still do what we want. We can still do as we please. So it's not true that we're not autonomous. We didn't realize that He would just do what we ask. But you know, more than that, it implies that they know what's best for them from their request. God just has to be asked because He's God, but we really do know what's best for us. So, we're going to ask Him not to send us into the abyss. We're going to ask Him for those pigs' bodies. We really know what's best for us, being embodied in this world, not being sent to the abyss. This is the best. And Jesus is more authoritative, and He's just told us we have to leave this guy's body. So, but we want a body, okay? And He's going to let us have one. So, what does that mean? It means we really did know what was best for us. But don't forget what happened to the pigs. They all drowned. So, the demons who thought that they'd be better off if they could get those pigs' bodies found within just a few minutes that their thinking was foolish. Milder term. Crazy. Nuts. So, when requests have nothing more to them than the desire to be allowed to pursue one's own course, they're nothing more than requests for autonomy. But you notice the contradiction there? If you're autonomous, you don't have to ask. If you have to ask, you're not autonomous. So the whole notion is just nuts. That's why I said one of the perspectives is nuts. So on the one hand, giving somebody who's ungodly their request, like the demons, simply hardens them in their own silliness. And Luke's point in recording that Jesus did this with the demons is partly to give us the picture of what happened next so that we wouldn't be as dumb as they are. Oh, Jesus, don't send us into the abyss. Our lives will be absolutely over if you do that. But if you'll just give us those pigs, our lives will be continuing to be good. Jesus says, you think that? Yeah, give us the pigs. Okay. And Luke records that, so we'll go around saying, oh, Jesus, give us the pigs. No. He wants us to see how silly that was. So that's on the demon side of it. But I said, when Jesus gives permission to the wicked, it's because of the way salvation works. And since demons are excluded from that, there's no redeemer for demons. Then we have to talk about humans. When we move to the area of humanity, the fact is salvation only comes to humans when the situation gets bad enough that a person can see the approaching disaster, the death that's approaching, and be motivated by what he's seeing to turn to God so that he can call upon him to be delivered from this disaster. You never ask for deliverance from a disaster that's not coming. Oh Lord, please spare Lincolnton from this hurricane. What hurricane? Well, there's not one, but please. You get my point? You don't ask for deliverance from stuff that doesn't exist. In God's dealings with human beings in relation to the salvation issue, it's always in view of some disaster that's looming or there. It's either there or it's looming. And that's the way salvation works. Nobody gets saved that doesn't first understand the disaster. That's a fact. Need has to be seen before a solution will be sought. It has to be. You're not going to ask for a solution to a non-problem. And salvation has this built-in requirement that men be able to see the disaster that's looming. And how will they see that if always they are spared from it by some well-meaning rescuer? That's one of the biggest faults in our culture, is that everybody wants to rescue everybody before those everybodies that need to be rescued even know they need to be. Well, my life's fine. What are you butting in here for? Oh, because we know better for you then. Yeah, right. But the fact is, until a person understands that the course he's on is a disaster, he's never going to turn from it. Why do you suppose that the same Jesus who went across the lake in the boat with the disciples, with the storm and all that stuff, went over there after having allowed those demons to possess that man for no telling how long. Why do you suppose he let them possess him in the first place? Well, we talked about that last week. He'd bought into this autonomy baloney so deeply that he had to come to grips with the fact that it was going to kill him. And, man, if 6,000, 7,000 demons possessing you doesn't convince you, then you're hopeless. Well, this man wasn't hopeless, except that he couldn't get rid of them. He finally understood what it meant to try to live a Jesus-free life. And he said, I don't want to be here anymore. Can somebody please help me? That's when salvation was possible for him. So God very often, maybe even the majority of the time, gives the wicked what they ask for so they can pursue their delusions until they wake up. If they never wake up, they never wake up. But they're sure not going to wake up as long as there's no need. So when we say that Jesus gave permission to the wicked and refused permission to the saved, we say it because that's the way salvation works. He lets people have their way long enough for them to discover that it's a destructive way. And then, maybe, they will call for help. Maybe. But the other side of that, you know, the question was, why does he give permission to the wicked and refuse permission to the saved? Well, Jesus gives permission to the wicked because that's the way salvation works. But Jesus refuses permission to the saved because that's the way salvation works. Did you get that? Salvation, by God's definition, is the insertion of love and wisdom and power into a situation of disaster so that the disaster is turned away and blessing is the result. That's the idea of salvation by God's definition. The insertion of love, wisdom, and power. And when you take the love as the motivation and the wisdom as the skill in applying it with the power to do it, you come out with salvation, deliverance, the being saved, blessing. Now, in this definition, there are those three parts. Love, wisdom, and power. Now, the problem with that is this. When God saves a man, whether it's physical or spiritual, he never saves a man who has a sufficient level of love, wisdom, or power. If he was sufficiently loving, he wouldn't have gotten that position in the first place. If he were sufficiently wise, he probably wouldn't have gotten into it. If he were sufficiently powerful, he'd already got out of it. So when God saves somebody, he saves them because they don't have love, wisdom, and power. That's his introduction into their situation. And because that's what salvation is, the insertion of things that people don't have into their situation so they can benefit from the fact that God does have it, because he does that, Jesus will very often deny a believer's request because the believer doesn't have the love, the wisdom, or the power that is necessary to be applied to his circumstance without wrecking what God wants to do there. This is where I told you, the longer I live, the more ignorant I become. I don't know what God's doing. I should have believed Solomon a long time ago. Solomon said, you cannot tell what God is doing by the things you observe. He said that in Ecclesiastes. I believe him. Now, I used to think that if you saw something happen, you said, well, now God means to... Who told you what God meant by that? Don't you believe that Solomon is more wise than you? And he said you can't tell. And you, but I hear this all the time. Something happens and some well-meaning, ignorant, unloving, unwise, powerless believer says, well, that means that God wants to do this or this or this. The fact is, more times than not, God will deny a believer's request because he has a plan for their participation in his glorious kingdom to come, and if he answers the prayer the way they ask it, he's going to ruin it. And he says, I ain't ruining it. I spent too much love and wisdom and power, making it possible for you to participate, to let it get ruined because you don't know what you're asking for. I'm not going to do it. In this case, the man in verse 38 was asking a very logical, rational, self-serving request. Jesus, please let me be one of your disciples. I want to go with you. I want to be with you. I want to go. It all sounds wonderful. But it was the natural outcry of an infant in the faith who didn't know what needed to be done. He just wanted his life. He was like the guys in Capernaum. After Jesus had cleaned the whole town out of people that were sick and demon-possessed, they came to him the next day and said, "Stay with us." He said, "But I can't. I've been sent to all of the cities and villages. I've got to go tell them all." No. Don't worry about them. Just stay with us. That way we'll get it, and who cares if they do? Well, look at verse 38-39. Admirable desire. The man from whom the demons had gone out was begging him to accompany him. Jesus, I want to go with you. This is the first time in my life I've ever had any life. Nope. Well, why not? Well, because that's the way salvation works. What do you mean? What I mean is, I want you to go to your own house, and I want you just to tell everybody that you come across what great things God has done for you. That's what I mean. Just go tell them what God's done for you. What good will that do? Don't ask that. Just do what I told you. Just go tell everybody what God has done for you. That's it. Well, you mean I can't go with you because you want me to tell them what you've done? You got it. But I'd rather go with you. Well, I'd rather you didn't. I want you to go tell them what God has done for you. Okay. So off he goes. He went away proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. Remember? Tell him what God's done for you. He's told him what Jesus has done for him. He got it. Now, what's going on here is, I said that it's because that's the way salvation works. Let me ask you this in big scale picture things. If the guy had been able to go along with Jesus and just suck up all the bennies of being in his presence all the time and then he died, what would his reward in the kingdom be like? Hold that. Now let me ask you this. Suppose he just does what Jesus tells him. What will his reward in the kingdom be like? You see, the problem is the Gerasenes. Jesus has this salvation thing. He's fixated on saving people. And the Gerasenes are within the scope of his mercy, and he wants to extend that mercy to them. But right now is not a good time. Why? Because he just destroyed their economy. Who's responsible for the death of all our pigs? Well, you want the truth. The demons are, but let's blame Jesus. Jesus, would you please leave? You've ruined our life. No, I came to give. We don't want what we said goodbye. So the Gerasenes were still intent on trying to live a Jesus-free life. And they learned nothing from the demoniac. You want a picture of what it looks like to live a Jesus-free life? Look at this guy possessed with almost 7,000 demons. And draw your conclusions about what it means to be in the dominion of spirits that are wicked rather than the spirit who's holy. Just ask yourself that question. That's what you want. That's what you're asking for when you want to be free of Jesus. Because you're not going to be free of the spirits. Some spirit's going to dominate. You live a Jesus-free life, and it won't be your spirit that's dominating. They didn't learn. Oh, well, there was always something wrong with that guy. He was always a little, we're not like him. Oh, baloney. What was his problem? He wanted to live a Jesus-free life. What's your problem? Well, I just seen Jesus got in the boat and left. What's the difference? But now's not a good time. See, right now they're mad at Jesus, and they're scared to death. He just destroyed all our hogs. So, what does Jesus say? Well, He says, I want you to go tell them. Just tell them. Every time somebody asks you, aren't you that guy that was possessed by all those demons? What happened to you? Well, tell them what God did for you. He said, Jesus delivered me. You know, two or three, 4 weeks after the hit in the wallet, death of all the pigs, the emotions have cooled down a little. And there may actually be some in those people of the Gerasenes that say, you know, I guess in the final analysis, being free of the demons would be better than being owner of a bunch of hogs. Maybe Jesus did have it figured out. You mean Jesus did that for you? Yep. Now Jesus went on he swung through the Decapolis some time later on a preaching tour. This was the area. So all those people that had time to cool off and think about it thought, you know, that guy that delivered that fellow from all those demons, he's going to be preaching down at the marketplace in a little while. I'm going to go hear what he has to say. You see, if Jesus satisfies this man's thoughtless, unloving, automatic, please let me just stay with you, if he satisfies that desire, if he answers that prayer, the Gerasenes will be without a witness, and their request, would you please leave, will lead to unmitigated disaster. If Jesus stays away, they're doomed. So at the present, the Gerasenes are too caught up in their own losses from the destruction of the pigs to understand anything, but the saved man, if he was going to do what Jesus told him, was going to be really saved. And that means he was going to be delivered from his penchant for setting his own course so that he could pursue a course that would bring salvation to others. And that's a spiritually significant action which will save your spirit. In other words, when God uses you to bring benefit to somebody else, he's just blessed you in time, in your spirit, with a significant result from your labor, and he set you up for glory in the kingdom to come. Those two are good reasons. That's the reason why he turned him down. Now, when it comes right back to us then, the question is, well, what should I pray for then? I don't think it matters. If you're one of God's children, you can ask anything you want to. And he may answer some of your requests, and later you may think, oh man, I wish I hadn't asked for that. But you'll be better off, because your reaction is, oh man, I wish I hadn't asked for that, and that'll temper your self-determination. It will. I want to share with you a personal, humiliating experience. After I'd been in the ministry for, who knows, 35 years, I knew of a fellow who, as far as I was concerned, hadn't practiced the ministry well at all, and he was going to retire, and he was going to have a diesel truck and a camper trailer to travel all over the United States, and I thought, this isn't fair. It's not right. He hadn't done what he ought to have done. And he gets to retire in this luxury of diesel and all that stuff. And I thought, this ain't right. And you got to understand, I like diesels. I just don't own one. I did once. But it turned into a pile of rust, so. But you know, as soon as I realized that all I was doing was being covetous and angry, and I repented. And then this rich man came along and said, Darrell, I've been studying your studies, you know, you've known us in church for several years now, and I've been getting all these tapes from you. And he said, the doctors told me that I'm going to die, and I want to get my stuff in order, and so I want to give you this motorhome. I said, well, fantastic. That's better than diesel and a camper trailer. But I remember it sitting in my yard here in Lincolnton, and I was thinking, this is an albatross around my neck. I can't find anybody that'll buy it. I don't want it. I shouldn't have asked. I didn't ask. I just got envious. And I learned. I'm not saying I learned a whole lot, but I learned a little bit about, you know, you define life in terms of stuff and you're going to always be disappointed. You define your life in terms of dealing with Jesus fairly and uprightly and saying, okay, that's what you want to do, I'll do it. You learn to deal with Jesus that way and all of a sudden your life will be totally different because you're dealing with the author of life. And when you go to prayer, be very careful. Jesus said, don't multiply words. People aren't heard because they say lots of words. I find myself more than not these days saying, God, I don't understand what you're doing, therefore I don't know what to ask you to do. I just want you to do what needs to be done. I think that's probably a better prayer life than the one I had for the last 40 years. God, don't you know you need to do this? Don't you need to do that? Would you do this? And more times than not, God's saying, okay, but it ain't going to work. I really do think that Luke had in mind in this paragraph the intention of trying to get the disciples to understand how necessary it is to trust Jesus, that is, walk with him by faith. And for a negative illustration, he gave us the demons and the Gerasenes, and he said, learn from them. Do not try to live a Jesus-free life. Try it to your own disaster. And then hope that there'll be mercy enough at the end. Let's pray together. Father, so often we chase things that are absolutely unworthy of our effort. And you are merciful, gracious Father. And we're glad. We're thankful that you have it in your mind and heart to deal with us as children of dust, whose frailties are far greater than their strengths. And your love just continues to be what it is. And we get frustrated and disappointed and all that kind of stuff. And you just tell us, hey, all that disappointment will be over with when you see me and you see what I've got planned for you. So, Father, I pray that you'll teach us that today. In Jesus' name. Amen.